Can you start by telling us about yourself and your experiences with prison?
Well, I grew up just north of Detroit in the burbs. I was in Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts. Probably nobody was more obedient to the program than I was. I went into the Army and spent 2 years miserable and traumatized. And then not long after I got out, the ex-boyfriend of the woman I was living with at the time kicked in the door. I stabbed him and killed him. And he was the nephew of the clerk of courts. So what actually happened doesn't really matter, because if you ever kill anybody more equal than you, you go to prison. So I've been locked up since 1991. And the more I protest that I didn't commit a crime, the longer the feds keep me held hostage. Go figure. So my experiences since I've been locked up, because I was a writer, I had a writing scholarship before I came to prison. And because I was a writer, I was writing for prison reform groups, how to reform the stuff. And that kind of annoyed prison officials. I had a psychologist at Toledo once tell me that the most annoying thing to people who run prisons is somebody who is articulate. So they hate that. So as a result of that, it kind of created this situation where prison officials hate me more as time goes on. So you would think they would just let me go. That's what I would do. But, what do you know?
Can you speak to the importance of prisoner support as part of the Anarchist Project, and specifically to the necessity of long-term prisoner support?
Yeah, I hope I can give you a sense of what it means to be the beneficiary of prisoner support. Because it's not about the funds, which are certainly nice, and it's not about the visits, which are also nice, but it's about a kind of sense of identity, too. And it's about validation. The prison complex does what it can to define each of us as offenders and inmates and criminals. They impose identities on us. So it's much easier to reject that kind of pathology when there's a base of support, when there's a group of people who know you and they define you differently. Because of those relationships and because of those connections, I have spent most of my prison time not in prison. And what I mean is, I'm real to people on the other side of the fence, and I'm present in their lives on that side of the fence. So that makes the prison fence somewhat irrelevant. I'm reminded of Henry David Thoreau, who wrote about how he marveled at his captors' blunders when they would confine his body in the jail but let his thoughts slip out through the bars right behind them when they left for the day. So for me, prisoner support isn't prisoner support. It's more like mind and identity reclamation. I exist on the other side of the fence, and I have meaning out there, which gives me meaning and purpose for getting up in the morning, because I care about those people and they care about me, and they make it possible for me to participate in changing the world. These people have reduced prison and captivity to a question of geography. I happen to be on this side of the fence, which is really meaningless, since my physical body isn't what really makes me dangerous to our common enemy. In many important respects, my physical captivity has become a practical irrelevancy, and people out there have made that true.
Earlier this year, you went on a successful hunger strike for more than 50 days. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah. First, I have to begin with a disclaimer that I have consistently said that hunger strikes are stupid. and they are. And they rarely work, because prison officials, going all the way back to like Margaret Thatcher dealing with the IRA hunger strikers in something like 1980, they'll either let you die if they can get away with it, or they'll torture you until you eat if they can't get away with killing you. So they're ruthless sociopaths. You can't really appeal to the consciences of ruthless sociopaths, because they don't have any. So this hunger strike was a partial success, because I got my communication mediums restored after 50 days without food. But that wasn't because of their concern for my health or any other such nonsense. It was because of outside forces that came into play. There's a website, lastblog.noblogs.org, where Ohio prison officials' home addresses were posted. I don't know, it might still be there. They decided I'm somehow responsible for that. I run the internet with my tinfoil hat from my prison cell, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, after 32 days on a hunger strike and no negotiations at all, I handed them the obituary I had written. That said, essentially, Swain's dead, the prison's director killed him, and they're denying it because they want to get security around their homes before they announce that Swain's dead. So, because Blastblog was out there, that scared them. And they realized that if that got posted online, people might actually get mad enough to do something. The deputy warden here, the deputy warden told me one morning, he came in at like 6:30 in the morning and he was pissed. And he said he was getting calls from exotic area codes, giving him death threats and things. So at the very least, 50 days of that nonsense was annoying enough for the state to make some concessions. So I have my communications restored that never should have been suspended in the first place. I don't know. I really hate hunger strikes because in a sane world, we wouldn't threaten to hurt ourselves to get what we deserve. We'd hurt the fascists who have it coming. To me, that's a lot more psychologically healthy to punch your enemy in the face than it is to refuse food. And the problem is they neutralize you before you get your hands on the ones who really got it coming. You know, senators, judges, corporate executives, and the NSA guy who's recording this. You know, those people.
So for years you've contributed regular segments to the Final Straw Anarchist radio show. What has this meant to you, and what do you hope it could mean to others and to the wider struggle?
Oh, wow. I mean, for me personally, it's kind of strange because when you're doing the segments, you know, I'm just calling on the phone just like when I'm talking to you. So I don't really get a whole lot of feedback necessarily. So it's almost like you're putting a message in a bottle and just flinging it in the ocean. You don't know where it ends up. But what's funny is that it seems to have an impact on the way that the prison administration deals with me. So I get I may not get a whole lot of feedback from listeners, but I get a good sense of the impact it has on the people who are holding captive. So that's kind of cool. And I'm hoping that by this happening, that it has an impact on how people view not just prisoners, but the relationship that people out there can have with prisoners, or should have with prisoners. That there's something possibly, potentially, of value in interacting with people who are in here.
So we're looking forward to the republishing of two of your books, How Emma Saved the World and Last Act of the Circus Animals, in the coming months. Could you tell us more about those stories?
Oh, yeah. Last Act of the Circus Animals was co-written with Travis Washington, who was another prisoner. And it stemmed from some conversations we had. He actually started it. I was really jealous because he hadn't really done any writing before that, and I was writing all kinds of stuff. And he comes up with this excellent metaphor of animals who are in the circus in cages, and they start talking to each other. And there's one panther in particular who starts raising the consciousness of the other animals as to the real nature of the circus, you know, the real oppressive nature of the circus. And he came up with what is actually the first chapter of Last Act of the Circus Animals, you know, and I read that. And that's all he was going to publish. And I said, well, no, this is the beginning. And he really didn't have any confidence in his ability to write what I was proposing. So he suggested that we just write it together. So I took over the writing aspect of it, and he and I worked on the remainder of the story and had that going. So it's kind of a metaphor. And Anthony Rayson was the first publisher distributor who put that out. And from 2007, probably over the course of about 2.5 years, that ended up everywhere. I was getting mail from like Russia. People in Russia had read Last Act of the Circus Animals. It was reviewed in the UK in the publication. And every prison I've been to somebody has walked up to me at some point and said, "Are you Swain?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And they'll say, "Are you the guy who wrote Last Act of the Circus Animals?" You know, and they expect me to be taller, I guess, or something. I don't know. But, yeah, that's cool that it's everywhere. With Dilemma Saves the World, I deliberately set out to write something as subversive as it could possibly be for young kids. So it's a story about a little girl who jumps on a couch, and she's told not to. So she goes into a whole series of investigations in order to find out why it is that she can't jump on this couch, and then undertakes to teach the adults what it is that they're missing, you know. So the idea behind it is that kids know something that we've forgotten, and that what they know is valuable. It's valid, and their experience of the world is valid. And it's very subversive in the sense that Emma, the main character of the story, is self-deferring, so to speak. She defers to her own sense of how things ought to be, rather than deferring to those who are supposedly in authority. So, in that sense, it's very subversive, too. So hopefully, if that book gets published far and wide, and a lot of kids read that, we'll have a whole generation of kids who are pulling the fire alarms in our school in the next few years. That could be really exciting.
What forms of solidarity have been most important to you while you've been in prison, and what could have been done differently or better?
There are some things, particularly after, in 2012, when the Army of the 12 Monkeys happened at Mansfield. I haven't talked about that yet. We'll probably get to that. After that had happened, the ODRC engaged in a regiment of torture under the supervision of the FBI. The FBI was actually involved in some domestic torture stuff. Surprise. And in response to that, there were some people who set up a website called Blast Blog. It was at blastblog.oblogs.org. I'm not sure if it's still there or not. But what they did is the people who had been involved in that torture regiment had their home addresses posted there with pictures of their homes and Google Map features so that people could find the quickest route to getting to their houses. Something that I noted from that over the course of, I don't know, let's see, that was in 2015, I think, in the spring. Over the course of the last 2 years since its existence, and prison officials have told me, like the highest levels of the ODRC have told me, that they know that I'm behind that. So they hold me responsible for what's going on the internet. And their entire behavior has changed in the last 2 years. Just to give an example, in segregation now they have big screen TVs. They have programs. They have people who pass out crossword puzzles. Segregation is no longer called segregation. It's a temporary housing program. On top of all that, they only now, it's policy that you only go to segregation for violence. Anything that's nonviolent, you don't go to seg anymore. There's no longer long-term segregation. Any kind of long-term punishment happens out in population in a special housing unit where you get programming. So everything that was going on when I went to segregation after the 12 Monkey thing and the whole torture regimen occurred, all of that has changed now. They've done a complete about face. And there's other reforms that the whole three-tier system they had before, which was a draconian. It was pretty draconian. It created a revolving door so people couldn't get a lower security. That's all been undone. So all of that came about, I believe, as a result of prison officials first there is the implied threat of their home addresses getting posted online. I'm sure nobody likes that. But on top of that, nobody likes to be seen as a torturer. Nobody wants to be publicly exposed to their kids and their wives and their neighbors and coworkers. Nobody wants to be seen that way. So in that way, Last Blog had a huge effect, I think. And it really changed the way the entire Ohio prison system works. So that's one thing. You know, the website is another. A friend of mine, you know, put together SeanSwank.org, and that kind of broadcasts my voice to a much larger audience than just, you know, within the prison system. So whether or not anybody's actually going to the site, I think possibly maybe, you know, five people keep visiting there. But prison officials don't know that. Prison officials, once there's a web presence, they simply assume that 7 billion people on the planet are going there on a regular basis. So it has an impact on the way that they behave. And I think on top of all of that, that there's the added unconscious in the back of their mind kind of fear that this is going to set a trend that other people are going to start doing this. Not just the website, but the Blast Blog. And things like that, you know, just theoretically, I'm not advocating this or anything in a recorded phone call, but this even has applications beyond prison complex because, you know, you have the same kind of the tactics that were employed by Stop Huntington's Animal Cruelty. Well, if you start having corporate executives' home addresses and all over the place, you know, this is something that has, you know, much wider applications possibly.
So you had mentioned the Army of 12 Monkeys, but we haven't heard a lot about that yet. Could you tell us more of that story?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing. I was at Mansfield, which is in the middle of Ohio, in the middle of nowhere, and seemingly out of nowhere, there were flyers in every single block, and they had some pretty cool graphics on them, and they were listing all of the things that prisoners can do in order to disrupt the orderly operation of the prison. In my own thinking, what was really kind of significant about all of this is that they didn't really pose any argument as to why prisoners ought to resist against the system or rebel. They just assumed that prisoners would already know. And there didn't seem to be any kind of political line that was being promoted or anything else. And there didn't seem to be any real demands. It was just seemingly rebellion just for its own sake. And at first, you have these thousands of flyers everywhere describing all of these actions that prisoners can do. And at first, nothing happened at all. Almost as if the whole prison compound, you know, the whole population was wondering if this is some sort of a practical joke, you know. But seemingly, then, immediately, you know, there was a 2 or 3 day lag, it seemed, and then immediately after that, there were staples and locks all over the prison. Somebody crammed potatoes down the drain in the kitchen and collapsed that, and that cost them like six figures. They had to dig up the entire floor of the prison and replace all the plumbing and relay all the cement. And then 3 days after they did that, somebody poured dry cement down the pipes and collapsed the plumbing again. So we're talking about six figures followed by six figures. And when you think about all of the locks that you have in a prison setting, when you start jamming staples and locks, it becomes really, really disruptive because nobody can perform the functions of their job. They can't get in their offices. So you had all of that going on. And then somebody lit the kite box on fire, which is kind of symbolic because the kite box is the box that you put communications in so that prisoners can communicate with staff. So that was lit on fire. The OPI factory, Ohio Penal Industries factory, was shut down continually by disruption and sabotage of the machinery, so they were getting no production done. And this went on for quite some time. 2 weeks into it, the FBI was there on site. Now, you know, you have, you know, Bloods, Crips, Gangster Disciples, Aryan Brotherhood. You have these prison organizations that have been around for decades, and I've never seen the FBI show up. So 2 weeks after the 12 monkey disruption began, the FBI was there on site, and they were doing ideological profiling, and they came and got me. So I was taken away. There were three of us, myself, Blackjack Jalilia, and Les Dillon, and they had us in the special management unit for about a year. And we were subjected to a special regimen that other prisoners had not been subjected to. It was really terrible. Sleep deprivation, starvation rations, extreme cold, you know, you name it. Filthy conditions. They cut the soap rations in half and then cut them in half again. And suspended laundry service. It was terrible. And then, you know, messing with the communications. They were actually photocopying all of my outgoing mail for a year. They had thousands and thousands of pages. In fact, the FBI now has something like 12,000 pages in my files. And the last time I contacted them, they said I could get a 3-disc set for $40, which is roughly what it cost for like the Sex Pistols box set. So I would recommend, you know, if you ever have the money, probably to go with the Sex Pistols, because you can't really go wrong with that. But yeah, as a result of all of this, they sent us off to the Super Duper Max. And those materials, by the way, the 12 monkey materials, are still out there online somewhere. And if it can happen at Mansfield, it can happen just in any prison, you know, at any time. And I think that's what really, really upset them, was that this happened seemingly out of nowhere, and it reminded them of just how powerless they are, because at any time, they can just lose control of an entire prison. Somehow I was responsible for that. But yeah, that's the 12 monkey thing.
So what are some of the challenges you've experienced in prisoner solidarity, and what do you think that we could collectively be doing better to support prisoners?
I don't like to be critical anytime people are attempting to do something. I would prefer to be critical of people who are attempting not to do anything at all. So having said that, there has been a focus in the past, and I'm not saying just anarchists, but there's been a focus in the past, particularly with reformist groups, of attempting to get legislative things accomplished in order to help prisoners, trying to get reforms instituted through things like the Corrections Institution Inspection Committee in Ohio, and other things like this. Lobbying efforts and so on. But it seems that what all those have in common that anarchists typically don't do is that this is an effort to do for prisoners what prisoners don't do for themselves. And I think what we need to focus on, is if there's something we need to consciously focus on, it would be getting prisoners involved in their own liberation. Getting us to realize consciously what power we possess personally and collectively, and getting us to act for ourselves. I think that is far more beneficial, especially for a long-term project, than anything that you see in this, you know, liberal, lefty, reformist kind of approach to things that has never really worked. So I think we have that going for us, because that's kind of like our inclination to do that kind of stuff anyway. So I would like for people out there to not assume that prisoners aren't down for doing something for their own liberation, and to assume that they are, and then to act accordingly. You know, like I said, those materials are still everywhere. You know, they're out there.
Do you see ways in which June 11th can contribute to addressing these challenges? And what are your hopes for June 11th this year?
It seems to grow in its visibility every year. And that's something that I like, particularly among people who are doing things. I mean, it's all good and fine, I suppose, if this starts to get coverage in mainstream media, and poor delusional hierarchs all over the world start seeing some different kind of orientation or trajectory regarding prisons and imprisonment. That's all good and fine, I suppose, but I don't know that that's ever going to go anywhere. What I like is that it seems the anarchist community all over the world is becoming more and more aware and more involved in June 11th actions and June 11th activities and events. So I think probably the next step is to make every day June 11th. That would be cool. You know, the more June 11th we can have in a year, the better off I think we are. It seems to me that it really is to everybody's benefit, you know, to oppose this kind of this kind of pathology, because prisons, like the military, are a kind of bulwark of this whole hierarch delusion. You know, it's one of the main pillars that prop the whole thing up. And if we can take away the power to punish, if you can essentially take away the prisons from the poor delusional hierarchs, then the whole system unravels, essentially. To be against prisons is really to be against the state. So I'm hoping people start seeing the convergence.
So what are your broader hopes and visions for June 11th and in the years to come, and prisoner solidarity in general?
Well, my hope is that a lot of things converge, and, I mean, I don't know, maybe this is too optimistic, but I would like to think that we succeed. And in succeeding, that means that, you know, the prison industrial complex goes away, and probably not without a fight, and that means that the state goes away, and probably not without a fight. So my hope is that that we develop strategies that cripple the systems of our enemy. That's my hope.
Yeah. Are there any struggles or moments in the recent past that have inspired you?
Oh, a couple, yeah. You know, there's the 1220 thing I already talked about. But there's also that call out that happened last September for the work stoppages that happened across the country. And, I mean, for me, I don't hold much stock in widespread work stoppage as a tactic or as a strategy in and of itself. But I think that's something that can be used as a springboard for something else. For instance, now that there's been the call out for the September work stoppage last year, and it had pretty decent success, that identifies for people out there people they can work with in here and maybe take things to the next level and the next level and the next. So I found that pretty inspiring. And there's a current struggle that I think probably a lot of people don't know about, and that is the Palestinian hunger strike that's happening in the occupier state of Israel. You have about 1,000 Palestinian hunger strikers striking. Now, I don't know how successful that's going to be, because they're up against a state that's probably just as ruthless as Margaret Thatcher was in Great Britain. So, yeah, there's that. But the fact that there is that kind of solidarity among prisoners there makes me hopeful that maybe we can generate the same kind of solidarity with prisoners in this country.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. I haven't heard much about that, but it seems really impressive.
Yeah, isn't it strange that here in the United States we don't hear anything that's really all that critical of Israel? Or anything that's really sympathetic to Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
How strange.
Are there any other projects or things that you're involved in that you're excited about and would like to share with us?
I'm glad you asked. Right now, with the planned publication of Last Act as a book and How I'm going to Save the World, I'm kind of thinking ahead. I would like to get Ohio published as a book. I'm thinking about this possibly for like 2018, and then running for governor of Ohio at the same time and using that as my platform. You know, getting together maybe enough funding from selling the book that we can we can get some bumper stickers and T-shirts and campaign pins and, you know, really make a real fiasco out of the whole election process. So that's my next big three.